It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from a guest who makes the case against space tourism. He says no life is worth losing over a billionaire's fantasy.
First, a controversy has exploded in the online world, centering around the hashtag Gamergate. The tag is shorthand for the unfolding story of a culture war within the gamer community and increasingly outside of it, too.
On the one hand, a group of gamers say they're concerned about journalistic ethics in the gaming industry and what they claim is giving unfairly sympathetic coverage to more outsider groups in gaming, like women and minorities. But front and center, there's been harassment and threats directed at women in the gaming world as well.
Gamergate took off when a game designer was accused online by her ex-boyfriend of sleeping with a game journalist for favorable coverage of her new game. The claim was proven false. No such coverage happened.
But the Gamergate movement started in response and took off since then. And women game designers and critics like Anita Sarkeesian, Brianna Wu, and Zoe Quinn have been getting threats. Things like rape, murder, and torture threats. And personal information has been released online in what are known as doxing attacks. Recently, Sarkeesian had to cancel an appearance at the University of Utah after threats of a mass shooting.
So now with that background, we're joined by Constance Steinkuhler. She's a former White House advisor on video games and learning policy and the co-director of the Games and Learning Society Center at the Wisconsin Institutes of Discovery at UW-Madison. Constance, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you just listened into that somewhat complicated saga of Gamergate. It has lots of levels and threads to it, but does that telling square with how you see it?
Yeah, I think that's a fairly accurate rendition, although I think the biggest debate is over whether or not this is really about journalism in the games industry or whether it's really about the increasing diversity of the medium and the response that a certain small group of gamers are having to that diversification.
Well, the gamer identity seems to be part of what's at stake here. And for a long time, the default gamer was seen as a white middle-class man. And now other groups, like women, are trying to come in, claim new territory, break new ground. Is this a case of the majority group sensing a sea change and responding maybe out of fear?
Yeah, except I don't think it's a majority group. I actually think it's a minority group. You know, it's interesting. The conversation publicly around games for many years has been that gamers are white, typically teenage males, and then some typical stereotypes go with that, like antisocial, you know, living in their mother's basements, et cetera, et cetera. And that stereotype has never really rung that true. But the way that media, that AAA, the most prolific titles, the biggest titles out there, are billed, one would think that that is, in fact, the main audience. If you were inside the game community, you knew that there was actually a really great diversity of gamers. But the loudest and most vigorous and most visible was, of course, this so-called stereotypical group. And now what we're seeing is that there's been this real backlash right now about the fact that games are diversifying, that the audience is no longer, we're no longer at a place where we can ignore the diversity of players. You know, it has always been that if you really wanted to tally it up, middle-aged women have always been the biggest gaming community. But the women gamers were actually playing things like Bridge Online, casual games. And for this so-called hardcore gamer audience, that was never sort of gamer enough. So they've been largely ignored in the market. As wireless devices have increased, and they are only increasing further, games have now proliferated to where a lot of the market is over on wireless devices, iPads, iPhones, etc., which means that the market is no longer willing or able to ignore that demographic. So the industry is changing.
Now, this began as an online feud, but it's spilled over into the real world. What kinds of consequences have some of the women involved seen and had to deal with?
Yeah, it's been really ugly, shockingly so. You know, women have gotten threats on their lives, on their livelihood. They have been doxxed, meaning that their personal information, their, you know, private pictures, their computer systems, their online sites have been hacked with home addresses given out. And death threats, rape threats being made. It's gotten incredibly ugly. And, you know, the pattern of it is really interesting and scary. You know, I think that this is a very small minority of, you know, for example, if you look at Reddit, it's a very small minority of actual Reddit gamer gators. It's like 10,000 people compared to the 6 million people on the main Reddit game thread. So you have this small minority. But when that group is sort of anonymously, individually making small, kind of small, devious, moves against a particular person, by the time you add that up, it doesn't matter that it's only a small fraction of the audience. The fact that it's 10,000 people acting in concert to kind of dismantle someone's private life and their public life, it adds up to something incredibly ugly.
Well, Adam Baldwin from the TV show Firefly is a Gamergate supporter, mm-hmm. and he says he doesn't condone the threats against women that have come out of this by some of these people. But there still is this subset you're just talking about, supporters who have used threats of rape, of murder, of torture, of mass shootings.
Yeah.
Does Gamergate as a whole, the bigger community, bear responsibility for them?
That's hard to say, right? I mean, Gamergate is really just a hashtag, so there is no control over who gets to post what. And I think there's a subgroup within the Gamergate sort of larger umbrella. I think there's a group that's really horrified by the attacks that are being made on women. And it should be noted here, too, that many men have spoken out and only women are being attacked in this way. So I think that there is a cadre that really feels like this is a distraction, not just a distraction, but a really egregious move to make. But when you have something as open as a hashtag, anyone can fly anything under it. Now, that said, I have to say that a lot of the debate right now has been framed in terms of issues of game journalism. And what's shocking and kind of hard to believe about many of the arguments are that in the name of wanting to clean up, so to speak, industry journalism within the game sector, they're actually attacking indie game designers and bloggers, which are really the minority fringe in many ways of the game industry. You don't see them attacking AAA marketing wings of industry and their relationship with mainstream huge writers and reviewers. So I think that there's something that must give here, because I don't think that the facts marry the claims about what this might be about.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that, because that is sort of the intellectual space that's being argued about here, about whether or not there is a legitimate argument that the relationship between game developers and gaming journalism is too cozy, and maybe that it privileges certain people. And in this case, you know, minority groups, maybe, and women.
Yeah, I think that's a fairly stretch of the imagination to believe that games journalism privileges minorities and women. Game journalism and games industry has privileged that main dominant white male view for as long as I've been in this industry as a researcher and as a scholar, but even before that as a gamer. That has always been the case. I mean, honestly, I think what you're seeing now is kind of the death rattle of an old paradigm that says that game companies have to cater to this one narrow view of their audience. Economically and culturally, scientifically, artistically, that is no longer the case. And that's what's really getting the backlash here. You know, the idea that this is about journalism when it's over a made-up case that never happened in the first place is really hard for most people to believe.
It does have some real-world legs, though, if you look at the decision that Intel, I think this is a $1 billion corporation here, made the decision not to advertise on one of the websites that GamerGaters don't like, seems to show that there is some clout there with GamerGaters.
Right. Yeah, it certainly does. I know that many of the people in the GamerGator movement actually, you know, really contacted and pressured Intel to drop their sponsorship of that particular outlet. So you're seeing real-world ramifications of it. Again, you know, I think that there certainly is a broader discussion to be had about the relationship in any given industry between journalism in the industry and marketing within the industry. That sort of relationship is vexed in any industry that you take a look at. So the problem here is that what's going on with Gamergate is actually being run under the banner of games journalism, when in fact it's just overtly sort of a tax on the diversification of the medium.
And so I guess that's the big question out there now. Is the gaming world welcoming for women, both as players and developers?
Well, you know, I have spent my entire career focused on thinking about games as an art medium. And the truth is that if you go back even to the 2011 Supreme Court case, in that case, it sided with protecting video games for First Amendment. And literally that ruling says, you know, like protected books, plays, and movies, video games communicate ideas through familiar literary devices and features distinctive to the medium. Video games are a medium, and and an art form. And their diversification only serves to increase overall the medium, its capacity, and its position within society. Games have cultural impact. You know, I don't believe, I certainly myself would never be interested in telling other people what to play. Or, for example, arguing that there are forms of games that simply should not exist. I might argue as a parent that I don't care to have them in my children's hands. But I do believe that a diversification of the medium is only in the best interest. And the irony here is that after working in D.C. and being the main front person who had to argue against anti-gamer movements and anti-gamer legislation and conversations again and again, the fact that games can be a compelling medium, that they can communicate important ideas, they can communicate, you know, everything from humor to fear and fright to, you know, aggression all the way over to drama, to role-playing, to even things like Zoe Quinn's, you know, game about depression. The fact that they're able to express so many different ideas is what protects them as something important and vital to our society. So the sad part here is that you have a minority group in games who are basically thwarting their own best interest. They believe that the claim that games are a medium for expression and should be an artistic form is somehow colonizing their game space, when in fact, that very fact is what's protecting their game space from being treated as nothing more but a small toy for children.
We're talking right now about Gamergate, the culture war playing out right now between those arguing there's a problem with journalistic ethics in the gaming community and those who've been threatened with rape, death, and torture in their efforts to change the offerings available for women, minority groups, and others in gaming. Constance Steinkuhler is with us, President Obama's former video game czar and the co-director of the Games and Learning Society Center at the Wisconsin Institutes of Discovery. We're talking about Gamergate right now, the culture war that's going on between those saying there's a problem with journalistic ethics in the gaming community and women and others who are trying to push the envelope on what gaming is. Constance Steinkuhler is with us, President Obama's former video game czar and the co-director of the Games and Learning Center at the Wisconsin Institutes of Discovery.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Are you a gamer? Do you play computer games, video games, massive online games? What do you think the scene is like for women there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We're going to go to our phones right now. Katie is first from Green Bay. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Veronica and Rob. And Constance, thank you so much for this important topic. It's so interesting, especially as a parallel to the recent discussions about the viral video of the young woman with the cat balls and just encouraging public dialogue about what is acceptable of women. And I think the backlash is most telling in both cases of people coming back and stating that, you know, these women just need to have a sense of humor or not put themselves in such situations. What do you think, Constance, has been, you know, your biggest takeaway from all of this, the positivity of the conversation being had or the negative comment being made toward females in these particular situations?
Okay, thank you for that question, Katie. Katie, drawing parallels between that and a viral video of a woman walking the streets of New York and documenting all the catcalls that she got from men and others as she walked and raising some issues about women's equality right now, among other things. What do you think, Constance?
Yeah, thanks for the great dialogue. What a good question. I mean, I have to be honest. As a woman in the games industry and sort of game culture scene, I consider myself a gamer. The ideas of having to prove if I'm gamer enough is certainly not new to me. But the amount of fervor is really surprising still. And I think it's been really surprising for the people who have been attacked and for the people on the sidelines as well. One thing that has been a little bit crushing for me in this conversation, to be honest with you, and the audience here, is that a lot of our leadership in the games industry itself and across the nation, who I know are not speaking out. And when isolated events happen where a man or two speaks out about this issue, nothing happens. But when a woman tries to stand up to defend herself or defend her colleagues, she's being absolutely attacked and slaughtered in pretty frightful ways. So I have been finding that really difficult, right? I mean, where is our leadership within the industry to show up and actually say that this is not what we're about, it hasn't ever been what we're about, and that this is an appropriate behavior? When I have probed this behind the scenes, you know, and tried to query what are we doing and why aren't we doing more, why aren't more people speaking out, what I find is that, you know, there's this old adage on the internet, you know, that don't feed the trolls. So a lot of the attitude is not because people don't care, but in fact that, you know, there's this dynamic of anonymity and just mass outpouring online. And, you know, the general feeling is that the more energy you give it, the more it just continues on and there's no way to really fight it. So I do feel like my biggest concern right now, I guess it's a conflation of, you know, some issues in gender that seem to really be percolating nationwide, and internet culture and lack of civility.
And you're on the show right now, and given the threats that we've detailed against some of the women who have spoken out, Brianna Wu and Anita Sarkeesian, are you worried being on the show today? Are you worried about what might happen?
Well, I have to be honest, you know, I mean, I am in many ways their worst nightmare. I've spent my entire career dedicated to diversification of the medium, specifically how games as a medium should be used for intellectual work, problem solving, you know, behavior change, cognitive change, etc. I'm also the person that defended the games industry to the Vice President of the United States and stood up and said, look, you know, games are not tied to violent behavior. This is not an argument that pans out nationwide, and that this is a medium of expression with incredible potential. Personally, am I afraid? I mean, sure I am, but I also feel like I'm a tenured professor in a magnificent state in the Midwest with a really supportive network of professional colleagues and a family that stands behind me. If I can't stand out on this issue, how can I possibly expect Zoe Quinn to stand out? How can I expect someone who works in the industry or writes for freelance? So, you know, to me, I'm sort of, you know, I sort of feel like the risks that I take are far less than someone who's actually working as a freelance writer or freelance designer.
Okay, let's get another call in on this. Wes is joining us from Minocqua. Hi, Wes.
Hey, are you there?
Yeah, you're on the air.
I play Call of Duty, Advanced Warfare, the new one on Xbox One.
Mm-hmm.
And just women get it on. Women I hear playing, and they are so much better than I am. But just the anger and the horrible language that I hear online, I've had enough of it sometimes, and I can't play, and it gets to be a lot, and it gets to be kind of frightening when you hear a kid playing and all of a sudden he starts crying because people will not leave him alone. It's like another form of bullying. But in the 21st century, it seems worse, I think. I don't know.
Okay, thank you so much, Wes. And question, he's getting it there. You know, the video game industry has been striving for a long time for legitimacy and to be viewed as an art form. Is this going to have serious long-term consequences for that?
Well, yeah, I mean, first off, I just have to say, you know, I've been there. I know what you're talking about. There are moments in which you just think, you know, am I really going to be part of this culture, at least this part of this culture? You know, it's like with any piece of medium. Think about television or movies, right? There are amazing forms of television. You know, there's Sesame Street for children. There's science shows for adults. There's Sopranos, which is not appropriate for kids, but it's certainly fantastic TV. There's a whole gamut of what we do around media, and games are no different. You know, I can't help but feel like, you know, first, all the gamers I know really are much more like you than the people who are calling out for hoping that, you know, the last woman who spoke out commits suicide out of the harassment they give her, which are posts that you see online right now on Infinity Chan. You know, I think they're a lot more like you or like me. The majority, the overwhelming majority of gamers are not interested in this, don't like it, and don't want to be be part of it. But part of that means that we have to stand up to it and say, you know, dude, back off. Like, speaking up and saying there's a basic level of civility that we have to insist upon. And I don't think that that necessarily can happen through legislation. I think that has to happen as a community of players. You know, one thing to keep in mind for the non-gaming audience is that talking about gamers in one fell swoop just no longer makes sense, because there are so many different genres of games. And now, in order to talk about game culture or game community, you really have to specify what platform you're talking about, what game are you talking about. You know, World of Warcraft players are nothing like the players of, you know, Threes or Two Dots or Bejeweled. So, you know, maybe it's a matter of we as communities of gamers have to stand up and decide what our community is going to be like.
Constance, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
That was Constance Steinkuhler, co-director of the Games and Learning Society Center at the UW-Madison. She was also Obama's former video game czar.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, with the recent announcement that one of Wisconsin's remaining drive-in theaters will be closing at the end of the season, we'll take a look at how the rest of the state's drive-ins are holding up.
First, news broke last week that a Virgin Galactic commercial spaceship had crashed in California's Mojave Desert, killing one pilot and hospitalizing another. The ship being tested was part of the company's venture into the new world of space tourism, which some expect to become a reality in the coming few years.
While the pilot's death is tragic, some are saying that it's just a price that has to be paid for humans to take the next step in space travel. But our next guest doesn't buy that. He says there's a big difference between practical space exploration and what Virgin is doing, and it's a mission he can't support.
Joining us now is Adam Rogers. He's the articles editor at Wired, and he recently wrote an op-ed there called Space Tourism Isn't Worth Dying For. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, in your piece, Adam, you say right up front you are fascinated by the idea of space and spaceships. You're not anti-space travel, but you say you can't support the idea of space tourism and what Virgin Galactic is doing. Why is that?
Well, I might even parse that further and say that I'm not even necessarily against space tourism. I think that sounds like it could be a lot of fun, although there aren't really a lot of destinations for it right now. But what I am, the question I do think we have to ask is whether, first of all, whether what Virgin Galactic is doing is actually space tourism or really just flying an airplane very, very high. And if it is, what connection it has to the kind of rhetoric that Virgin Galactic and the space tourism industry in general will employ, which is that they are trying to build the next step in human evolution and pave our pathway to the stars, all of which may be totally fine as well, except now we know that people are dying for that. And if you buy the rhetoric, then maybe that makes the risk something that you want to be part of. But I'm becoming less convinced that the rhetoric of what Virgin Galactic says they're doing is actually connected to what Virgin Galactic is really doing.
So how would you characterize what they're really doing?
Well, my sense from the way they themselves describe what the business is that it's what sounds like, if it worked, would be an amazing ride for some very wealthy people. And I'm not sure that I see the connection between that and space exploration.
Now, do you see other projects going on like SpaceX and others as more maybe valid paths toward what we think of when we think of the frontier of space exploration as compared to what you're saying is more a thrill ride in a way?
Yeah, I probably could identify those, although I'm not sure that I have the expertise to say which of them is going to be successful and which of them won't. I think it's pretty evident that what SpaceX is doing is designed to actually go into orbit, for example, and that while it doesn't start with tourism, it starts with a business model, which is getting NASA to pay for ISS resupply. And I think it's fair to point out there that SpaceX has, at least at one time, had a deal that they haven't talked about much in recent years with Robert Bigelow, who has a business trying to build inflatable space stations using some technology that NASA abandoned that they'd planned to use in conjunction with the space shuttle. So the idea, again, being that you have a destination for tourism that actually is in space, that's in orbit, and that becomes part of a larger plan that that Elon Musk has talked about, which is trying to get humanity off Earth and to the moon and to Mars for some reasons that I see as being very practical as well as very cool. I mean, I'm very much a science fiction nerd and a science reporter. I believe in this stuff. I just don't think that that's the same model that Virgin Galactic is espousing.
Well, is it possible that this suborbital thrill ride sort of concept may not really take us into space where we want to go, but it might be a viable business model that could solve some engineering problems and pave the way toward parts of the future of space travel?
Yeah, and I guess if it turned out that, in fact, a rocket launched from a high-flying plane was a way to get people and things into space at some point down the line, then I would be wrong. Sure. All I have to go on is what's in front of us right now. But I would also say that if what you're asking is, could there be spin-off technologies from this, then I would say there's got to be a better way to find those technologies than hoping that they spin off of something that is obviously dangerous, potentially futile. And if what you're asking, because another iteration of that question, another version of the question is, well, doesn't this at least get people excited about the idea of going to space? Doesn't it at least keep us committed as a people to the idea of a space program when our governments don't seem to be able to commit to one? Then I would say that what you're actually talking about there is a PR campaign. And again, there's nothing necessarily wrong with those, and I want to go to space too, but now somebody is dead because of that PR campaign. And that's the thing that worries me.
And there's been some writing in the media looking at the pilot here as a hero, almost maybe a martyr in the cause of future space exploration. Is that the wrong way to be thinking of the sacrifice the pilot made?
Well, listen, that's obviously a tragedy, and I that's the thing that made me want to write in the first place, was feeling the emotion very keenly of this death of a person who, I think it's safe to say, loved being a pilot and obviously assumed those risks, understanding what those risks were. I think it's possible, and I'm a little uncomfortable with arguments by analogy, but I'll make this one. We know as a society how to honor the sacrifice of a soldier who dies for his or her country, but still ask important questions about the war in which that soldier fought. I think those can be separate issues. What this person did was obviously assumed a lot of risk, did something heroic. The person who's been injured was the same thing. But that doesn't change the fact that we can still ask questions about whether what that company is doing is the right thing. And I think it's really important to pay attention to the fact of who, Scaled Composites, which builds the engines here, had a few years back 3 deaths as they were testing their rockets. The people who have died so far are not the rich people who are going to pay, presumably, for the privilege of doing this. They're the workers who are building the technology. That's who's being put at risk here, and that's who's taking the risks. That's who died. And I think we can still ask whether the ultimate technology is worthwhile without, without seeming like we're denigrating or putting down the people who've suffered for it, because I certainly don't mean to do that.
So as you've said, you are not opposed to space tourism, space travel, space exploration. What would be a worthier mission, one maybe worth the loss of life for knowing participants?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, you're asking me to step pretty far into speculation, and I'll do it, but with the recognition that I'm a reporter who's covered this field for a long time. I'm not a person who actually does it, right? So you and I know what that's worth. But I would say that you want to get off the planet, and you want to have a permanent, you want to be reaching toward a time when there are permanent settlements for humanity somewhere other than Earth, because we know that either because of something that human beings do or because of a naturally occurring event, something very bad is going to happen on this planet. Asteroids have wiped the planet clean before. They will do it again. And if we want to survive as a species and as a people and have our cultures survive, we have to have backup copies of ourselves somewhere else. That's what we should be aiming for. And that's, as I say, that is eminently practical and also really, I think, stirs the blood and the emotion. That's what I would like to see.
So this crash and this loss of life, some people have said, hey, this is just a setback for space tourism. It's not something that's going to end it altogether. Do you think we should pause and rethink the concept of what we're doing when it comes to space tourism and space technology?
I think that's a really important question, and I would say that the distinction that I'm trying to be crystal clear about, and it is certainly possible that I'm failing, is between the concept of space exploration and even the concept of space tourism and the fundamental concept of the business model that Virgin Galactic is pursuing. Virgin Galactic has a a technology that is challenging to build and really cool on its own terms. But I think the connection to space travel, space tourism, space exploration is tangential at best. It flies the plane that they have now, if they get it working, flies to the bottommost definition of what we would consider space. It doesn't go into orbit. It doesn't seem, except in the broadest sense, to have applications for going any further than it does. It's a thrill ride for rich people. That's the thing that I want to be asking questions about. If all it is to get people excited about going and getting to play astronaut in the hope that that's going to lead to those other programs, I think that's misguided.
Do you think we as a culture are as excited as you would like us to be when it comes to that pure mission of getting us out into space?
Well, I'm not totally... I don't know. This makes me feel like I lose my science and science fiction nerd bona fides when I say something like this. But I'm not totally convinced that that we should be excited for exploration in space for its own sake. That's no pioneers or explorers have ever done that. Nobody goes just to go. Some people go just to go. I shouldn't say nobody. That's tarring with too broad a brush. But I would say that when we go, when we commit, what's the saying, blood and treasure, mm-hmm. for grand national or grand planetary goals, we do it not just because it's going to be awesome. We do it for a rationale. We do it because there's trade at the other end of it, or because there are cultural reasons, because there are scientific reasons. We do it because there's a benefit to the cost. And I do think there's a benefit to the cost of aerospace as a science, of space exploration, of space travel. Like I said, we need backup copies. We need a permanent human presence somewhere other than Earth. I think that's really important. But I would see us pursuing that.
All right, Adam, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Well, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
That's Adam Rogers. He's the articles editor at Wired. His piece on space tourism is linked over at the Central Time Facebook page. There was a time in American history when the best way to take in a movie was your local drive-in, whether you piled the entire family into the Bel Air or saw a double feature on your first date with that special someone. Seeing a movie under the stars was a special experience.
These days, though, drive-ins are getting few and far between. Many have gone out of business, and in Wisconsin, we're about to lose one of our few remaining drive-ins. Last month, the owners of the Kino Drive-In in Pleasant Prairie announced they'll be closing for good after 66 years of operation. And that got us wondering, how are Wisconsin's remaining drive-in theaters doing, and what does their future look like as Americans' movie-going habits continue to change?
Joining us now to discuss these issues is Charles Bruss. He's a Wisconsin drive-in historian. He's the writer and director of the new documentary 41 Twin Outdoor Theater, Starry Skies and Silver Screen Memories. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So after decades of operation, the Kino Drive-In is calling it quits. According to their Facebook page, this coming weekend is going to be their last. What do you think did the Kino in?
Well, the 35-millimeter film has always been the standard for showing movies in theaters. And over the past 10 to 12 years, digital has become increasingly the way that movie companies are going. An average 35-millimeter print to show in a theater is around $3,000 to $5,000 a copy. So when you times that by 3,000 to 4,000 theaters, you can see how much that is. Digital, I've heard that they can either do it with a satellite download, or it's basically an encrypted disc, you know, a regular digital CD disc, and $5, you know, so. It's all about cost for the film companies. So they basically warned all theaters, you know, 10, 12 years ago that this is coming and you need to switch your projectors to digital projection or you won't get film. So a lot of theaters, indoors and drive-ins, over the course of, you know, the past 10, 12 years have been slowly changing to the new format at a cost of about anywhere from $75,000 to $80,000 per projector. So if you have multiple screens, you can see how costly you can get. And for drive-in theaters, the projection booths, you know, a lot of them are like standalone little buildings in the middle of the field. Well, they also need to be heated, air-conditioned, sealed up completely, because all the electronics that go with digital projectors are very sensitive to those kind of changes. So, you know, for, you know, drive-in, they'll have to spend at least another $5,000 just to get their booth up to speed, too. So it's a major cost, especially for drive-ins. And the Kino, apparently has decided not to do it. And this is most likely going to be their last season.
Well, Charles, you're someone who loves drive-in theaters. What sorts of emotions are you going through when one like this closes down?
Well, with the 41 Twin, that one closed in 2001. I got to work there the last 2 years it was open, and I got to see a drive-in from the inside out, not just as a patron. And so, you know, for me, you get a little more emotionally attached to the property. Each drive-in seems to have its own personality, if you will. It's the way it looks, feels. You know, memories are made there. You know, maybe you go there as a kid and you grow up watching all the movies and you got your fond family memories, and you know, basically now when the drive-in gets torn down, it's kind of like part of you gets ripped away, and it's sad. You know, it's sad that a drive-in has to get torn down all the way, you know, to make way for quote-unquote progress, just like we need another housing development or another office building, you know. But, you know, to me, it's just history. They've been around for so long, and they've shown so much film history of different genres. It's just sad to see it go.
So what is it about the experience of seeing a movie at a drive-in theater that makes it special?
Well, you know, indoor theaters, you know, here's your start time, you know, whether it be 7 o'clock, and you get in there, hour and a half later, it's like, get out, you know. Drive-ins, it's an experience. It's, you can get there at, you know, when the gates open at 7. The movie usually doesn't start for a good 2 hours. A lot of people bring their ball and glove and frisbees and play in the front of the screens. And a lot of drive-ins, you know, in the States still have playground equipment. So you get to come out and let the kids run around and burn off their extra energy. And the food at the drive-ins, most of them are very, very good with their selections. And, you know, and then of course you get two movies for the price of one. You know, indoor theaters, it's $10 one movie. And in a lot of drive-ins still have like 12 and under free or 10 and under free. So it's more almost more economical for a family to go to the drive-in as opposed to going to an indoor theater.
And so we're losing the Kino, it looks like. How would you say the rest of the drive-in theaters are doing in Wisconsin, those that we have left?
They're all doing, from what I've heard, pretty good. The only one that hasn't converted to digital is the Twilight Outdoor in Chilton, Wisconsin. Although I was told 2 years ago that when I talked to the owners that, oh, yeah, we'll switch, no problem. They haven't switched yet, as the last I've heard. But if they said they're going to do it, I would assume they're going to do it. And one of the other drive-ins that I was worried about was the Stardust drive-in up in Shatek. The owner had socked away a lot of money 2 years ago, and he had a very bad spring, and he had to burn through a bunch of the money he had saved up for the projectors. But he switched one of the screens. He has a two-screen drive-in, so one of the screens went digital this year. So at least that ensures that he'll be able to get, you know, movies for next year. Because it's just really getting hard for, like, and I've seen the Kino this year really struggling to get the movies that they want to get, because they're just not making as many prints. So you basically have to wait, or they're just not making 35mm prints at all. And then you're kind of shut out of the really big movies.
Do we moviegoers still want the drive-in theater option, or are we, you know, we've got so much home entertainment, and then there's still the indoor theaters, maybe we don't miss them so much?
I think it's the opposite of that. I think, you know, back in the 80s, you know, the drive-ins really took a hit. Their numbers, you know, went down by well over 1,000 in numbers over the course of that decade, partially because of real estate values and then people's changing views on, well, now we got cable TV, we got VCRs, we can stay home, and that was the case. But nowadays, I think families have really found the drive-in again and the experience of getting together as a family and going to the movies, getting out of the house. You know, so I think the popularity of the drive-in has actually come back a lot. You know, in Wisconsin alone, we've seen drive-ins actually get built in this state. Twilight Outdoor in Chilton was actually built on a Walmart property. The Walmart moved to a different area in town, and the drive-in was built on the parking lot of the Walmart. And usually it's the other way around. Walmarts are tearing down drive-ins because they're cheap land. And you know, so I don't know. I just, the popularity has come back. And I've seen a lot of people commenting on the closing of the Keno and how much they're going to miss it. And I think it's kind of a tragedy for the community to lose such a piece of history. But, you know, you never know. I guess until they actually come in with bulldozers to tear it down, there's always hope that it'll come back, you know, hopefully.
Now, it's getting easier these days to have a really good movie-watching experience at home. You can have your surround sound, your comfy sofa, lots of movies on demand. But it also, in a way, it sort of homogenizes the movie-making experience. Do you think that maybe the fact that we can watch movies like that at home could actually help drive-in theaters?
Well, you know, as far as sound and stuff goes, I mean, the audio for the movies comes over your car speaker or your stereo in your car now. So most people have, you know, almost Dolby sound in their car with, you know, kick and bass systems and all that kind of stuff. So it's almost like being in an indoor theater with the great sound. So I just think that the drive-in experience, you just can't beat it. You know, people could, you know, say they want to sit home and watch movies in the comfort of their own living room. Well, and I say get out and enjoy the outdoors. You know, you just can't beat that experience.
Charles, I got to ask, what's the last movie you've seen in a drive-in most recently?
Oh, I was up at the Keno last weekend. Saw the original, well, not the original, but the remake of Halloween, the Rob Zombie version, which actually for a remake wasn't too bad. And then they showed Scary Movie 4 and Scream 4. Now, all those movies have been out for a while, and that's one reason why they were able to get prints, because, you know, the prints are still available. But, you know, it was Halloween weekend, and they went with three horror movies.
It's a great Halloween experience, Charles. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That's Charles Bruss. He's a Wisconsin drive-in historian, and he's the writer and director of the new documentary 41 Twin Outdoor Theater, Starry Skies, and Silver Screen Memories.